It is 1:25 p.m. Monday, January 9, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ameson and Juno Elia, who make sure we have sound. I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, and myself. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 5, Sexual Assault Definition of Consent, sponsored by Representative Tarr. We will now rescind the motion to remove House Bill 5 from committee. I have a motion, Representative Snyder.
I move to rescind our previous motion to move House Bill 5 out of committee.
Hearing no objection, that motion carries. I have a motion, Representative Snyder.
I move version 32-LS0065-R of House Bill 5 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
There's an objection, Madam Secretary, if you'd please call the roll.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Snyder?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
Representative Eastman? Representative Kirka, not present. Representative Vance?
Yes.
Chair Klayman?
Yes.
5 yea, 1 nay.
So by a vote of 5-1, House Bill 5 moves from committee. Our second order of business today is House Bill 325, Domestic Violence, sponsored by Representative Rasmussen. We will now rescind the motion to move House Bill 325 from committee. I have a motion, Representative Snyder.
I move to rescind our previous motion to move House Bill 325 out of committee.
Hearing no objection, the motion. You're objecting to rescinding action?
No.
Okay. Hearing no objection, the motion rescind carries. Representative Snyder, may I have a motion?
Yes, I move version 32-LS1526-A of House Bill 325 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
There is an objection, Madam Secretary, if you'd please call the roll.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Snyder?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Kirka, not present. Chair Klayman?
Yes.
5 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 5-1, House Bill 325 moves from committee. Our third and final order of business today is Senate, and please stay around to sign the paperwork. Our third and final order of business today is Senate Bill 182, Interference with Emergency Services, sponsored by Senator Wilson. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Wilson and his staff, Jasmine Martin. Please come forward, identify yourselves. Actually, it's only Jasmine Martin. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks. And I recognize that Representative Kirka joined us at 1:28 p.m.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. The Senate is still on the floor right now, so Senator Wilson sends his regrets, but he is on the floor. So I think half of the committee has already heard this legislation. I hope those of you that do will continue to support it and enjoy hearing about it again. Senate Bill 182 establishes the crime of interference with emergency services. 911 is a service we often take for granted. Whether you call one time or 1,000 times, an operator must answer. 911 centers are an essential link in our emergency response system, and abuse of the 911 system is happening and is currently an issue. These operators are genuine and incredibly hardworking, and it's incredibly frustrating for them to repeatedly answer calls when no emergency exists. These calls severely impact public safety and emergency response by delaying responses to real emergencies. Dispatchers are required to put callers with genuine emergencies on hold to answer the same caller for the 1,000th time. For example, a dispatcher could be required to replace the parent of a choking child on hold in order to answer repeated calls from a harassing individual who is not in need of emergency services, delaying necessary life-saving measures. Senate Bill 182 addresses this issue by making interference with emergency communications a crime. This bill would make it clear that it is a crime to call 911 repeatedly when there is no new emergency, and an emergency dispatcher has instructed the caller to stop. Makes it a crime to call 911 repeatedly, knowing there is no emergency. It makes it a crime to threaten a 911 operator during a call or physically disrupt emergency communication systems. In the past, law enforcement has attempted to use other statutes such as harassment, false reporting, and disorderly conduct to stop interference when it occurs. Often these efforts are dismissed by prosecuting attorneys because of the ambiguity of the statutes. This bill has the support of many affected agencies around the state, including the Department of Public Safety, Alaska Association of Police Chiefs, Anchorage Police Department, the Mat-Su Bureau, and many others. There's a whole packet of letters in your packet. And with that, I'm happy to cover sectional if the committee would like.
Go ahead with the sectional, please.
Section 1 adds a new section to AS 1156. This is our criminal laws offenses against public administration. So this is all new language essentially in the bill. It establishes that the person commits a crime of interference with emergency communication when they call 911 to elicit a first responder response for a previously reported incident when they've been instructed to stop calling, or if they make repeated 911 calls when there's no emergency, if they threaten a 911 operator during a call, disrupt emergency communications between 911 operators and first responders, between two first responders, or between a 911 operator and a person reporting an emergency. It clarifies that that part does not apply to in-person communications, just remote communications. And then it defines emergency communications, emergency communication center, and emergency communication worker. These definitions were taken from the National Emergency Number Association definitions, and then finally establishes that this crime is a Class B misdemeanor. Section 2 adds a section to uncodify law that specifies that this act is not applicable to offenses committed prior to the legislation. And with that, that concludes my sectional. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, I'll note we have actually, before we get to questions, we're going to go to invited testimony. We have two individuals online for invited testimony. The first is Jacob Butcher, communications manager from MATCOM Dispatch, who's on teleconference. Mr. Butcher, if you want to proceed, and just for the committee's note, because I know four members of the committee have already heard this bill. I'm going to let the invited testimony go first, so that if there's questions that come up that are more directed to invited testimony, we can direct it to them. Mr. Butcher.
Good afternoon, and thank you to the chair for hearing our testimony today. My name is Jacob Butcher. I'm the communications manager for MATCOM Dispatch. I've been a 911 emergency telecommunicator for nearly 16 years in South Central. During my time in this profession, I've answered countless emergency calls for help from members of our community. I've been instrumental in providing emergency life-saving support, such as walking a wife through bleeding control instructions on her husband, de-escalating a suicidal subject with a firearm in their hand, and providing a new mother with CPR instructions on her infant child. These are the types of incidents every emergency dispatcher handles on a day-in and day-out basis and can occur at any given time on any given day, which is honestly part of the fulfilling aspect of our work. It's important to understand that not every 911 call ringing into the center is life and death emergency, yet every call must be answered and processed in an appropriate and efficient manner to determine if that actual emergency exists, because there's no way to tell what is on the other end of the line before it is answered. Those calls which are not emergent can normally be handled in stride with grace and education to direct non-emergency 911 calls to the appropriate resource. However, there are some instances where explanation and education just cannot surmount the disruption caused by intentionally false, disorderly, and harassing calls to the 911 center. I can attest with personal experience over the July 4th, 2021 holiday weekend in which our 911 center was more or less attacked by two separate forms of this interference with emergency communication. One form was through computerized call spoofing in which false emergencies were reported with the intent to obtain a large response from both law enforcement and EMS. These spoofing calls placed a total of 45 false reports within a 24-hour period, each of which needed appropriate call processing, follow-up, and vetting to ensure the reported incident was false. These calls tied up resources from MATCOM, the Department of Public Safety, Anchorage Police, and Anchorage Fire Departments, among others. The second yet simultaneous issue that the center encountered was a member of the community who was upset with the way a previous case had been handled and chose to air their frustrations to the 911 dispatchers by dialing the emergency number over 80 times in one day, only to unleash a barrage of profane, insulting, and extremely vulgar expressions on the telecommunicators before hanging up. Concurrently with these disrupting calls being placed, the communication center staff was left attempting to sift through the false and harassing incoming calls to provide actual emergency assistance and responses to a myriad of real-life emergencies, which included a reported drowning with ensuing water rescue efforts, two plane crashes, one of which involved two parents and their young child, four separate reported wildfires, and one full structure fire. I ask that each member of the committee place themselves in the position of calling 911 seeking help for your loved ones and being placed on hold for a false or harassing 911 call such as that. Most true emergencies are those where seconds count, and that's not a sacrifice that we can afford. SB 182 would provide a mechanism in which law enforcement could react swiftly to resolve these disruptions to our essential public safety infrastructure. Quick resolution to the disruptions can free up the 911 lines, unencumber the emergency telecommunicators and responders, and expedite these resources to the members of our state with true time-sensitive emergencies. I appreciate the concern and the attention that can be brought to this matter today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next for invited testimony is Joel Butcher from the Alaska President of the Association of Public Safety Communications Officials and the National Emergency Numbers Association, Mr. Joel Butcher, as opposed to Jacob Butcher, presumably no relation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, that is correct. As president of the joint chapter of AFCO and NENA in the state of Alaska, represent about 153 current members and 380 telecommunicators across the state working in approximately 50 plus PSAPs. I've heard from members throughout the state on this issue when it was brought forth, and it's a real problem across the state of Alaska, and it's important to our members that this legislation moves forward. When these incidents occur, and they're not like everyday occurrence type issues, but when they do occur, it's really crippling to the 911 center to receive repeated calls like Mr. Jacob Butcher expressed over the phone. So I'm going to just if anybody has any questions, feel free. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. So time for questions from members of the committee. We're on our usual one-minute limit per question. And if you have a question for either Mr. Butcher or Mr. Butcher, you should tell which Mr. Butcher you'd like to have answer the question. Questions from Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am one of those individuals who has not heard this bill before, so if my colleagues can forgive me if I'm asking questions you already know the answers to, but this is to the bill sponsor and his staff, Mr. Chair. Can you help me understand the motivation and the implications for the change establishing this crime as a Class B misdemeanor when it was previously a Class C felony? And I have one follow-up, but I'll start there.
Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So when we originally drafted this legislation, it was a Class C felony if the interference resulted in serious harm or death or after repeated convictions under the statute. And then it was a Class A misdemeanor otherwise. Senate Judiciary had concerns about some of that, and they brought it down a little bit. And then House State Affairs had the same concerns, so they ultimately removed the C felony and brought it down to a Class B misdemeanor. So that was the motivations of the committee. They thought that that was a more appropriate punishment, and that's something that Senator Wilson was supportive of as something the committee wanted to do.
Follow.
Representative Snyder.
Could you provide some additional detail to what those concerns were, if you recall? You said there were concerns that resulted in it being reduced, and I'm curious what those concerns specifically were.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Making people felons. Members of the committee were interested in not making people felons over this and interested in just bringing the punishment down a little bit. Considering that, again, 911 centers are something that we call often, and wanted to make sure that we weren't over-criminalizing this behavior.
Final thought.
And just as a note, Representative Snyder, the sequence in state affairs was like one could call it a layered approach. The First Amendment, which was one I offered, reduced it from the removed the felony provision and just made it a Class A misdemeanor. And then the second amendment offered by Representative Price Tompkins reduced it from an A misdemeanor to a B misdemeanor.
I see.
All right, follow. Yeah, go ahead and follow up. But I just wanted to make sure you knew the context of how that played down in state affairs.
That's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhat related. The way this is written, if it's determined that an individual who is committing this is actually experiencing a mental health crisis, does that preclude, the way it's written, intervention through alternate means other than bringing someone to jail, for example?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, no, in the same way any law. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that same line of questioning, I guess what would happen in that situation where, okay, so we see where this is a problem, this is harassment, but what about a situation where the intervention or the harassing leads to death? Is there not a stiff penalty? Are we totally stripping that out?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, not under this legislation. There are other pieces of law when something intentionally negligent or harmful behavior results in death that people might be charged under, but that's not something we're changing with this legislation.
And for purposes of clarity, if you want Ms. Schroeder to come and address the question about what happens if conduct led to death, whether there are crimes available in the current statute to address that, Ms. Schroeder can come forward and provide us insight. This is on the criminally negligent homicide topic that we addressed in state affairs. This is the risk that she provided the testimony earlier, so I know who to call on to answer the question.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Kirka, Chairman Klayman is correct. There are other crimes, homicide crimes, such as criminally negligent homicide, and those types of manslaughter, those types of crimes that would be available if we could prove a causation issue. So, but I think that linking those two up may be difficult, but if we could, there are crimes in the books available to allow us to attempt a prosecution.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Schroeder. So you said that linking them could be very difficult. Which I guess makes sense. You would want to be just done so innocently. But what can you describe? What would have to happen in this circumstance to make that connection?
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, we would have to show that the act of repeatedly calling 911 jammed up the system so badly that somebody was not able to receive help, and that act caused the person's death. So that there was no other superseding or intervening cause, anything like that. So, and that the causation issue would be the biggest hurdle in that case.
And just by way of background, the causation topic or causation issue would also be present under prior versions of this law, that the provisions that allowed prosecution for something that caused death, you'd have the same causation issue under the prior version of this bill as you would have under criminally negligent homicide. I think the only difference, and Ms. Schroeder can confirm if I'm incorrect, under criminally negligent homicide, the mental state to prove liability as a crime would be criminal negligence, which is actually a lower mental state than what you'd need to prove the homicide provisions under the prior version of this bill, which would be knowing as to conduct and reckless as to circumstance. Representative Kirk, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Schroeder. So, had a train of thought there, and see if I can get it back. So, you would have to be able to prove that their actions caused the disruption that caused this person to die. So, what would I guess? I'm trying to think. Okay, so say someone's dying, and they call 911. And they can't get hold of somebody. Does that qualify? And they end up dying, and it's proven later that they could have been saved. Is that what we're talking about, or something more particular?
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, I think we're getting closer. Your last comment about we would have to prove that they could have been saved. So it would have to be the fact that the system was jammed up so badly that law enforcement, that is what caused law enforcement not to get there in time to save the person, and the person could have been saved. So that's a lot of steps to go there. That's why that will be the challenge in those types of prosecutions.
Representative Drummond.
I get that this kind of offense needs to be prosecutable or arrestable, for lack of to make it an arrestable offense. But I'm trying to figure out whether this bill makes the person stop. How do you make the person stop interfering so that the communications emergency communications worker can actually continue to do the life-saving work that they were trying to do? Can once you identify a phone number from which harassing or interfering phone calls come from, can they then ignore calls from that number? I'm not understanding how this makes the harassing behavior stop.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, and just for the record, they want to answer the phone calls. They don't necessarily want people to be calling them repeatedly with no emergency, but at some point that might be an emergency. That person that called 100 times might be having an actual emergency at this point. They want to answer that call. They do not want to not answer it. The first part of how this bill works to get it to stop is simply being able to say, what you're doing is illegal, please stop. Right now, they don't necessarily have the ability to say that because it's kind of ambiguous whether some of this behavior is illegal. The second part is, again, now you have the law behind you. Maybe you can ask a police officer to stop by to talk to them. And in serious circumstances, you can arrest that person. And, of course, they're not going to be calling 911 dispatch centers from jail.
Follow up?
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. So if the communications emergency communications worker can then say to the caller, what you're doing is illegal, please stop, are they then able to hang up on them or put them on hold? I'm trying to figure out how the communications worker gets back to the true emergency.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, and if we could, I think that's a great question for the emergency communication workers we have online.
Sounds like a Jacob Butcher question.
Thank you, through the chair. For the record, this is Jacob Butcher, communications manager for MACOM. When dealing with these calls, it's of utmost importance to determine if there is an emergency that exists. Through the example of July 4th of last year, that's ultimately what happened. How we ended up getting back to the actual emergencies and work at hand was recognizing those numbers that were coming through. However, there is an obligation to still answer those once it's determined whether it's through just the vulgarities that are being screened at the telecommunicators from the caller on the other end or what have you. We do have the option of disconnecting those calls. That's not the most ideal thing on any 911 call, but the option that we have is answer and determine there's no emergency and then disconnect.
And just to play some of the discussion you're having in context, I recall from early in my EMT training, a paramedic describing this situation that most Friday nights there was an elderly person that tended to call the 911 number saying they were having heart palpitations or other medical symptoms, and the EMTs would arrive and the person was really happy to see them and all smiles. And at one level, it's on the edge of harassing, but on the other hand, this is a person that is of an age in which they really could have all those symptoms, and I think the paramedics tended to go and recognize the person and check them out and make sure they were okay and go on, and I never had the sense, even though they knew these were repeated calls, that anybody wanted to come and say, stop making the calls. This was just part of the reality of doing paramedic work, that sometimes you have people that call when they may want attention more than anything, but we don't want to chill those. We don't want to have a chilling effect on those calls, even though they may not always be necessary, because sometimes they turn out to be necessary. That through the 10th call, they are having a heart attack, and you don't want to cut them off when they're having the heart attack. And that's the balance that we try to do with the bill. I know that the question you asked, but that's kind of more information on the topic. Any follow-up, Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Now, the bill before us just deals with emergency communication workers, and we have a definition of emergency communication center. So that would not normally apply to firefighters or police officers or EMTs or paramedics. Does the language in this bill, does that parallel how we treat interference with these other first responders and other statutes?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, I am not sure. I would have to get back to the committee on that. What I can say is that I'm not... What we're talking about generally is calls that are coming into a center. So a citizen calling into the center and interacting with a dispatcher as opposed to two dispatchers interacting with each other. One part of the legislation that does address the interaction between medical services personnel is that page 2, line 6 there, where it talks about interfering with the physical or the equipment used to communicate between first responders.
Well,
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, it would be helpful, I think, if there's anything else that we already have in statute, say, you know, someone is pestering a police officer, asking for their help and in a way that's criminal already, trying to distract them from helping someone else or trying to interfere if somebody's trying to, you know, help somebody out of a wrecked car and somebody's interfering with them. If there's any statutes on the books currently dealing with interfering with first responders, whatnot, I'd be curious to know to what extent it parallels or is dissimilar with what we have in the bill here. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we can come back to questions. Let's go ahead and get public testimony opened up, and then if there's further questions following public testimony, we can certainly come back to those. And I also note that Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, is also with us today. If there are questions for her, we're going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 182. If you're on the phone, please make sure you are not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it is often difficult to hear what you're saying. First, I'll ask if there's anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony. Hearing and seeing no one, then looking at the roll, I don't see anyone else online who would like to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 182 and open it up. Any other questions from members of the committee after we heard those illuminating pieces of public testimony? All right, hearing and seeing nothing. We are going to hold House Bill 182 for further review. And we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, May 11th at 1 p.m. As I think we all know, in the last several days of session, we may be delaying the time here and there. And if you are, however, considering offering an amendment to Senate Bill 182, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Tuesday, May 10th. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 1:53 p.m.